out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 29th of November, 2018, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're broadcasting live at Radio Erin because we've got Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson with us. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm hanging in there, Sven. I'm hanging in there.
Good man, good man. Well, we've got some really good news, actually, to begin the show with. And you were discussing it yesterday in the Orthodox Nationalist. And that's this Russian supposed Holohoax law has been struck down. Is that actually what's happened, Matt? Has it been struck down? The law is no more? Or have they refined it so that it excludes historical researchers? Just exactly what is it that's happened that we should be so pleased about?
Well, specifically what's happened is that a defendant, Romanushkov, was acquitted of violating that law, which is very, very vague and doesn't mention Jews or the Holocaust at all. It was a suit that was brought against him by a local Shabbat organization in Perm, in the Urals. And the jury was actually very, very firm, saying that this has nothing to do with a scholarship. It has nothing to do with actual research. And the law, you know, as I've said many times before, the law is about protecting the state. And it's only that Shabbat has and other Jews have tried to make it into some kind of a Holocaust law. I mean, even, you know, as I said yesterday, it was condemned by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. The same people who support the laws in the West condemn the Russian version because it really has nothing to do with this. They tried to use it, against this guy because he pissed them off in a serious way and it failed miserably. So when they acquitted him, the law was, at least that aspect of it, was null and void.
So the precedent was set that somebody that is investigating what went on in World War II, they are outside of this law if what they're doing is presenting facts and figures that that haven't been heard before. Is that what it's saying? So if somebody had done some research and discovered that, say, that there wasn't any cyanide in the supposed gas chambers and showed their scientific research, that would be outside the remit of this law?
That's correct. Any kind of political speech, you know, any like a column, a newspaper column, an article, a book. You know, the thing was such a joke because Ushkov himself said, you know, mainstream Russian publishers put out this stuff on a daily basis. You know, there's mountains of stuff. You know, you could build a ship with the material that mainstream Russian publishers put out on the Holocaust every year. The only reason this guy was prosecuted is that when the Hasidic Jewish organization moved into Perm, they took over the government, local government there, and Ushkov organized the movement against them, and he won. The Jewish press in Russia says that the federal government supported Ushkov 100%. They tried to even get the patriarch, the church, involved and were rebuffed. So it was a huge – and not to mention the fact that now their takeover of the government of that part of the Urals is now national news in Russia, and actually probably Eurasia too. So it was a huge defeat for them. Now, the Jewish press in Russia says that certain Shabbat groups have been expelled from Russia on the grounds of their extreme point of view, you know, Gentiles are animals, that kind of thing, and because a lot of their funding comes from New York. And the Russian laws have always taken aim at organizations that get a lot of their funding from abroad. Now, that's not about the organization as a whole, but they claim – I have not been able to corroborate this, but the Jewish press there claims that certain cells in other cities have been kicked out of the country.
I'm quite surprised at that because the Chabad Chabad Lubavitchers, I mean, they're a really big Jewish organization. They certainly have a lot of influence in America. And I would have thought they had a lot of influence with Putin. I'm sure I've seen him with some of these Chabad types. Is it the whole of Chabad that's been kicked out, or is it just fringe elements of it?
No. There's a Jewish newspaper called Cursor, K-U-R-S-O-R, that reported this. I mentioned it in my broadcast yesterday. They also said that, you know, the federal government was backing this. It wasn't the organization as a whole. It was a few local branches that were particularly obnoxious. You know, Putin is such that, you know, he doesn't need them. He doesn't need their money. A few pictures with the rabbi doesn't, you know, prove anything. He's taking pictures with them. You know, and they've actually organized protests against him in Russia and Ukraine and elsewhere. So they're not exactly friends, but because Putin has a power base separate from any real money source or certainly any Jewish source, you know, their power is very limited. But it was not the organization as a whole. That would be a huge deal, but that didn't happen. I have not been able to, though, find other sources that corroborate that particular claim. But that's what Cursor claims.
Well, it's good news anyway. It's definitely good news. And at least there we go in Russia. You know, they're free to investigate what went on in World War II, which is really going to be the subject of today's episode. We're going to have a look at, some of these other laws that they've got, which basically just prevent investigation. America and Britain apparently don't have them, which I'm really surprised at, that Britain is actually standing up for free speech in this case and saying that, well, we're not going to go along with these laws. But the rest of the EU has gone along with them. And I've got, from Wikipedia, what it says about these laws. It says, Holocaust denial, the denial of the systematic genocidal killing of approximately 6 million Jews in Europe by Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 1940s is illegal in 16 European countries and Israel. Many countries also have broader laws that criminalize genocide denial. Of the countries that ban Holocaust denial, some, such as Austria, Germany, Hungary, and Romania, were among the perpetrators of the Holocaust. And many of these also ban other elements associated with Nazism, such as the expression of Nazi symbols. So what do we know about these other countries that have got these laws, Matt? I wouldn't have thought that it was too strong in places like Romania and Hungary. I mean, they had serious problems with Jews, didn't they? From what I've read, anyway. I'm surprised that, and also they're ex-communist countries. So what are the laws like over there, and what are your thoughts on these 16 European countries and Israel where it's banned to investigate it?
Well, there's no question that this shows the immense power of Jews as a group. There's simply no denying it. This is unknown, and it's only them. There's no other group that's protected this way, at least no other ethnic group that's protected this way. Remember, Hungary voted down the law in 1992, so they don't have it, and it shouldn't surprise you. Romania, their connection with the European Union means it's pretty much obligatory. That would also be the case in Bulgaria, although I'm not aware of a national law in Bulgaria that parallels the European Union law. You come into the Union and you're automatically covered by it. I think the Belgian case is one of the more obnoxious, because Belgium created the Center for Equal Opportunity and Opposition to Racism, which is the English translation of the French. It's a government agency that sounds like an activist group. They actually form protests. They give free lawyers to anybody who claims any kind of, you know, any kind of discrimination or anything like that. They get about 7 million euros a year from the Belgian state. I don't know how much from the EU as such. So I think that's one of the worst, outside of Germany and Austria. The interesting place is, the Czech Republic or Czechia, because while denial or gross minimization, I think is the term, is illegal. In the Czech Republic, they also say that denying communist crimes is equally illegal. Now, I don't know if that's ever happened. I don't know if there's been any, I can't find any prosecutions in that respect. But it seems odd because as far as I know, there's a lot of communists that were members of the old regime that are still around, and there was no Nuremberg for those guys. So I'm not sure how seriously to take it. Now, you guys know the Gaysuit, however you pronounce that idiot's name, in France, created the law in 1990. He was a member of the Communist Party and part of the assembly that criminalized Holocaust dissent in any way whatsoever. And so the Communist Party, you know, it was passed universally in the assembly. And, you know, the whole thing, what gets me is that so many of these claim authority from the Nuremberg Code, and the fact that people aren't aware of how ridiculous that trial was, and gets to me. The torture that was used, the fake evidence, the fact that defense wasn't allowed to do research on their own. And one of the most ironic aspects of the Nuremberg trial that these people often refer to is that one of the great punishments that they threatened people with, you know, to testify the right way, is sending them to the Soviet Union. You know, you testify the right way and we won't send your family to the USSR. And yet the USSR had a judge at the Nuremberg trial. So they're admitting that these people are lawless and oppressive, right in the trial itself, and yet they still had a judge there. You know, Nuremberg was a way for the Soviet Union to cover over their crimes. And for some of these laws, I like the French law to make reference to it as some sort of an extraordinary authority. You know, sometimes I don't have the stomach for it anymore. It's so ridiculous. It's on so many levels, it's wrong. And it's still today, it's venerated as some sort of a holy writ.
Yeah, the Nuremberg trials, they weren't even allowed to enter any of their own evidence. And evidence didn't have to be entered for things that they said were just generally known by people. So if they could say, well, it's just generally known that people were gassed in World War II, they didn't have to provide any evidence to actually prove that anybody was gassed. There's no autopsy reports for anyone that was gassed in the whole of World War II. And when a country has to join the EU, as you were saying there, Matt, when any new country joins the EU, they automatically have to institute Holocaust denial laws, and they also have to set up Holocaust remembrance centres as well. That's another part of it as well. It's central to the European Union ethos. And this Nuremberg trial that they had, where basically the people the supposed victims were the judges. The people that were supposed victims of the war, they were the judges over the people that were being accused. And that's set a precedent which has been followed ever since then. I mean, when I was doing the research into this, I looked up Nuremberg trials, same as you did, and it was saying that this was the model that is now used for trying Milosevic, they would have tried Gaddafi, they'll try to try Gaddafi's son, and they've actually got no right to be doing this. It's an international court. Where do they get the sovereignty and the jurisdiction from to anoint themselves as the judges over other nations, over other people, especially when they're the ones that carried out all these war crimes? They also absolved themselves from the very same war crimes that they were accusing the Germans of. I mean, this was a total kangaroo court that has set the precedent ever since. And that now they've made these laws that to deny that or to point out all the inconsistencies in it, that's Holocaust denial. So people that point out all these facts about this kangaroo court, such as you were saying there about the people that were tortured, the confessions that were brought under torture, that's Holocaust denial. To point out that dozens of them, I can't remember the exact number, it may even be 100 of them, had their testicles smashed beyond repair. And that's why they signed these confessions. And their families were threatened with being sent to the Soviet Union, where they'd get raped by the Red Army and get sent to the Gulag if they didn't sign these confessions. And yet our courts today say that if you have a confession that's under torture, then that is, you know, that gets overturned. That can't be used. And yet we know that these confessions about their gassing millions of Jews, they were all obtained under torture. I mean, what else do you know about these confessions and about these the trials, Matt, some more of these inconsistencies?
Well, one of the worst aspects of this, apart from everything that you've already mentioned, is the fact that you have major people like William O. Douglas, in the court, was on the Supreme Court at the time, who condemned this whole thing. He said, if this happened in the U.S., it would never be permitted. But somehow, you know, it's permitted here. If this is the model for, what I was trying to say is the forgeries, the so-called, the book Hitler Speaks, which was published in Britain, allegedly supposed to be his personal conversations. It's one of the things that was part of the evidence. It wasn't published at the time yet, but the individual talks were entered into evidence. The so-called, Hossbach Protocol, 386 PS, I think was the exact code name of the document, was a total forgery. And they were using this in the prosecution as if this is the most damning evidence possible. But something that Holocaust researchers have found that impressed me, one of the most impressive things, I think the number of papers that they took from the archives, I think was about almost 500 tons of paper. And despite their forgeries and despite the tortured confessions, there's not a single syllable that they could find that where Hitler ordered the gassing of all of these people. They can't find it. But these men were condemned based on forged documents and everything else. And even the Moscow Declaration of 1943 said that the verdict is already in. This is 43. And the Soviets said when this court is convened, which they had already considered, even though it took a while in the West for the Jewish National Congress to convince the Allies to do this, the Soviets wanted it done, and they said they're already guilty. They also said, as part of this Moscow Declaration, that those who are accused should be shot on the spot by those who they victimize. So a trial in the Soviet mind was exceptional. They didn't want a trial. They said they simply should be executed. And if you guys can't do it, just send them over to us. So this is one of the reasons that they always said, we're going to send you to the Soviet Union if you don't testify. So, you know, and all of this was the OSS, who really was at the root of this, along with the Jewish Congress, engaged now, we know for an absolute fact, engaged in a massive black propaganda campaign throughout Europe and America to promote these ideas, to promote this as a necessary step, and that this is the fairest court imaginable. And these people are guilty, and they lied. They just made stuff up, which is nothing new. But as far as this being a model for, like, you know, Milosevic and Hussein and all this, you know, these people have to be guilty in their mind, because how can they have a trial of someone like Milosevic, say, and then at the end say, oh, wow, sorry, we were wrong. He's innocent. Oh, sorry about that. Sorry about bombing your country. You know, they can't do that. So there's no way that a trial can be anything other than a kangaroo court. And as you might notice, Milosevic was the only one that they sort of tried. They killed him in prison. But everybody else died or was killed before they were able to be tried. And I think the reason for that is that if you read the and it's all online in English, the transcripts of the Milosevic case, he was blowing them out of the water. He defeated all comers in debate over what happened in Kosovo and Bosnia. And this they can't have. They were turning off his microphone and, you know, cutting him off and things like that. And that's, you know, they're afraid to be exposed. And that's what these laws are all about. That's what these trials are all about. It's fear of exposure.
Do you know about the White Book, the German White Book that they produced, which was all the documents that was showing that they fought a defensive war? Have you heard about that? I was discussing it the other day, and we looked for it online, and there's no mention of it in Wikipedia or anything like that. But you can actually find it. And I think the reason they say that it's not able to be used as evidence is because the government was no more. Even though it was government documents and it was proof that they fought a defensive war, they were not allowed to use it. Do you know anything about that at the time, whether there was any mention of it, that the Germans did have all these documents to prove that they didn't fight an aggressive war?
Well, I think the colored books refer to the, you know, of the 500 tons of documents that they took from the archives and any surviving, you know, city hall or anything they could get their hands on, a few hundred thousand pages were extracted as damning evidence. And they published them in books. I think the main one was the Blue Book. There was a Green Book And then I guess the white book would be its opposition. The problem is that the documents that, I mean, now we know today, and the OSS was aware of this at the time, that there were plenty of documents that they found exonerating the Germans, you know, on specific crimes and in great detail. And those have been lost. Those were shredded. And even the defense lawyers who had, you know, very little authority at these trials knew of some of these. And whenever they tried to request them, you know, say some German officer said, oh, I know there's a document that says so and so, they couldn't get their hands on it. So they either lied, shredded it, or just kept it from them, because no defense lawyer was allowed to go through these documents. The Green Book and the Blue Book were the only things that these lawyers had access to, but those were compiled by the prosecution. So I think now, so they color coded these books, given topics, given the issue, and given how damning they are, as far as I know. But the books, the documents that exonerated the Germans were never given to the defense attorneys at all.
Yeah, and they deny that they exist. I mean, to say that there isn't a page for it at Wikipedia, I mean, that's saying that they still deny that these books actually exist. When did they actually come out with these laws then to prevent people from investigating it? I mean, it's got a very Orwellian term, isn't it? The Holocaust denial laws. And it's basically anybody that actually goes to places like Auschwitz and tests it to see how much cyanide there is, or looks to see where the chimney is, whether it could actually work, whether these gas chambers could actually work or not. Anybody that actually does this research comes under the heading of Holocaust denial. So when did these laws come about, Matt? And why did they come about? What was there lots of people that was sort of saying, well, hang on a minute, this isn't true? Or did they wait until lots of people had died that knew the truth, and then they started to bring it out? When did all this come about?
The very term Holocaust, according to Michael Hoffman and a few other people, doesn't predate the mid-60s. You know, trademark word that refers to only the Jewish deaths in the war is a fairly recent provenance. Now, I think Jewish power had to reach a critical mass in the West, which was roughly, I would say, maybe the early 70s. You know, prior to World War II, you know, criticizing Jews and mainstream book publishers, you know, wasn't that uncommon. It wasn't a mainstream thing, but it wasn't like today where you'd have your house ransacked and everything else. World War II was the absolute watershed for them, and that eliminated their opposition. But they needed propaganda to slowly but surely bring Western populations to think in Jewish terms. And I think I say this because the first French attempt, the first attempt to criminalize was in France in 1972. But I also don't think it's an accident that almost all of these laws are after the Cold War was over. The first being the first real one. There were anti-racism laws in France in 72, but, The Gay Suit Act of 1990, I believe, is the very first one. And that was kind of the model legislation based on the Nuremberg verdicts. And it was, so much of the left, so much of the so-called, you know, cultural Marxism really hit hard once the Soviet Union fell. The left completely morphed itself and started talking about, they didn't talk about working class anymore. They started talking about, you know, they replaced the proletariat with women and Jews and non-whites, because the working class didn't exactly run to their side. But I would say certainly in by the very latest, the early 80s, Jewish power had reached such a critical mass that they now they feel comfortable in repressing dissent. So these laws were passed in almost every case unanimously in European parliaments. Starting in 1990, and then they just like dominoes one after another. And then after the Maastricht Treaty, it now became Europe-wide. But as far as the First Amendment in the U.S. is concerned, that only refers to the federal government. In the United States, private capital controls far more than the state does. Private capital is not doesn't have to follow the First Amendment. But private capital is also how we publish things in this country. You know, whether it be, you know, Facebook, or the big book publishers or the journals or universities or newspapers, these are all private corporations. And so while it's true that the government will protect our right to free speech in this respect, that's really a meaningless. If in fact we lose our jobs or we get fired or we get beaten up or they attack us, you know, to the point where we can't function anymore, something like that. Yeah. The government protecting us is absolutely meaningless if in fact the private sector then is free to attack us. What makes the United States interesting in this respect is that because private capital is so dominant, and in fact, you know, many government agencies are already privatized. Yeah, the First Amendment is a dead letter because corporate control takes care of the rest. Private actors are the ones that can oppress us, not necessarily the state. And private actors are far more powerful than the government is. And the last 5 years, I'd say the last 5 years, definitely, it's now fashionable to, you know, lose your job, to be destroyed personally, physically, economically, emotionally. In the public, in the private press, the state really isn't all that relevant.
You know, it makes me think of Amazon there. I mean, you used to be able to get a lot of historical revisionist books at Amazon, and they've banned all of them now. And Amazon is the main book publisher. It's effectively banning these books from being seen anywhere. You can only buy them from the independent publishers now. And yet they will come out with all this World Book Day and censorship of books, and we mustn't have censorship of books, but all the revisionist books are now censored at Amazon. Now, as I was looking at the Nuremberg trials here, one thing I noticed, it was talking about the Kachin Forest. Now, as far as I'm aware, the Germans were convicted of doing that. They said it wasn't us. They had all the evidence to show that it wasn't them. They called for independent witnesses to come over and look at these bodies in the Kachin Forest, and it couldn't have been then. It could have only been the Soviets. And I thought that they'd been found guilty of that, and that was a part of the Nuremberg verdicts, and therefore to say that it wasn't the Germans responsible for Kachin, that was Holocaust denial. Then in the 80s, when the Iron Curtain fell, the Russians said, well, actually, it was the Soviets that did this, and it's in our archives, but it wasn't actually changed. Now, when I was looking on Wikipedia, it says that during this Nuremberg trial, it was brought up that the Germans did this, and the Allies refused to find the Germans guilty of it, and they looked over it. So what's the truth there? Did the Germans get found guilty of the Kachin massacre, or did they not?
They were found guilty of that by Nuremberg, and even more than that, they were producing documents that proved it, and no one knew any better at the time. It took the fall of the Soviet Union for these documents to come out. And so much of that, you know, those documents that came out of the old KGB headquarters are extraordinary. You could spend a lifetime going over them. Only some of them have been translated. But, you know, they prove everything the right wing said prior to that was correct. I mean, McCarthy was understating the problem. The point is, they were convicted. They were convicted on forged documents and tortured and God knows what else in terms of confessions. Now, the fact that that happens to be true, no one denies that anymore. I do believe you can still be prosecuted on those grounds. And I say that, though, because the last time I spoke to Frederick Tobin, the Adelaide Institute in Australia, one of the things that struck me was he said that the judge in his various trials, said that the truth of the matter is no defense. In fact, I think that's the title of one of his books. The judge said it doesn't matter if these things are true or false. It's that they offend, you know, these people. And so it's either a book or an article that he called Truth is No Defense. So that's the official Australian court position. So the Kachin massacre, no one denies it's the Germans anymore. But I think technically it would come under Holocaust denial. We could say the same thing about Auschwitz. How many times has that plaque been redone? Whoever makes those plaques is a millionaire, because every it seems like every few weeks they have to revise the number way down. I think they started off, it was like 16 trillion Jews were killed here, and every few years, they lowered it and lowered it and lowered it. So I guess according to that, the 6 million figure has been jettisoned. But denying the 6 million figure is a crime. And I think, I believe, I might be wrong here, but I think the Austrian law specifically mentions that number, although the rest of the laws don't mention it at all. It's really minimization, you know, words like that that they use. So you deny the 6 million, of course, it's correct. And even, you know, Raoul Hilberg and all these other people will tell you it's correct, but you can still be prosecuted. So like in the Tobin case, truth is absolutely no defense.
So Wikipedia are even trying to cover it up today and pretend that it didn't actually happen. And yet there are still places in Europe where you could be imprisoned for saying that it was the Soviets that carried that out. And it really is a shocking attack on free speech. It's something that really needs to be talked about more. And you hear about the civic nationalists and they complain about the fact that they're not allowed to criticize Muslims. You just think, well, for the last 20 years, we've had elderly men jailed for, you know, years at a time just for publishing the results of their investigations into what went on in World War II. And I think really the generations today, I think they're far more woke to this. I mean, Holocaust jokes, that's why people make them. It's because there is no evidence that these Jews were gassed. There is no evidence that, you know, these awful atrocities actually happened. Yes, the Jews were treated badly in the war. Everyone was treated badly during the war. The British people, the European people lost far more people than the Jews. And yet we don't have special days for all the Europeans that were lost. We don't have special memorials. Never again will we have a brothers' war. It's always never again for the Jews. Matt, thank you very much for coming on today. I'm so pleased that Russia struck that law down. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.